Airing first on Asheville FM, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting out of occupied Cherokee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world.
This week I spoke with Nava Smolish, author of the essay The Opposite of Rape Culture is Nurturance Culture, which became the seed of her book Turn This World Inside Out, The Emergence of Nurturance Culture. This book was recently published by AK Press and was written under the pseudonym Nora Samaran. We talk about harm, entitlement as related to positions of power like masculinity and whiteness in our cultures, the need for connection ingrained into our biology and sociality, accountability, and healing, among other topics. You can learn more about Nava at navasmolash, that's navasmolash.wordpress.com, and find further reading up at norasamaran.com. You can also find a list of suggested further readings by searching How to Not Re-injure Survivors. Next weekend is the Another Carolina Anarchist Book Fair, or ACAB, happening in Asheville, North Carolina. Events start on Friday with a welcome table at Firestorm from 1 to 7 p.m. During that period, there will also be presentations on veganism and nonviolent direct action, transnational and indigenous poetry, anti-racism in Appalachia, the revolutionary abolitionist movement, and anarchism in Puerto Rico. That night, Pansy Fest begins with a show at Sly Grog Lounge at 7 p.m., and this sparks a weekend of activities from 11 a.m. till about 2 a.m. around the city. If you want to learn more about either series of events, you can check out acab2019.noblogs.org or pansycollective.org. Or give a re-listen to our August 4th episode of The Final Straw. And please come visit our table if you're in town on Saturday or Sunday and say hi. We'll be at the Mothlight. We're lucky enough to include Sean Swain in this week's broadcast. If you've been missing him on your audio emissions, you can find a link to his audio essays up at our website. He produces one every week. And you can find updates on him at seanswain.org or now follow him on Twitter at SwainRocks. Please be aware that his 50th birthday is coming up on September 12th, so send him some love and kindness. Also, if you're in town for ACAB, swing by the Final Straw table on Saturday, August 24th, before noon, to participate in a birthday surprise for Sean. Shh, don't tell him. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
Willem van Spronson was gunned down by government agents on July 13th after he launched a one-man guerrilla attack on the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, a concentration camp for immigrants. Willem wrote a final statement before launching this attack, and it's posted at loveandragemedia.org. The following is that statement in its entirety. There's wrong and there's right. It's time to take action against the forces of evil. Evil says one life is worth less than another. Evil says the flow of commerce is our purpose here. Evil says concentration camps for folks deemed lesser are necessary. The handmaid of evil says the concentration camps should be more humane. Beware the centrist. I have a father's broken heart. I have a broken down body. And I have an unshakable abhorrence of injustice. That is what brings me here. This is my clear opportunity to try to make a difference. I'd be an ingrate to be waiting for a more obvious invitation. I follow three teachers. Don Pritz, my spiritual guide. Quote, love without action is just a word, unquote. John Brown, my moral guide. Quote, what is needed is action, unquote. Emma Goldman, my political guide. Quote, if I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution, unquote. I'm a head-in-the-clouds dreamer. I believe in love and redemption. I believe we're going to win. I'm joyfully revolutionary. We all should have been reading Emma Goldman in school instead of the jingo drivel we were fed, but I digress. We should all be looking at the photos of the YPG heroes, should we falter and think our dreams are impossible. But I double digress. Fight me. In these days of fascist hooligans preying on vulnerable people on our streets, in the name of the state or supported and defended by the state, in these days of highly profitable detention concentration camps and a battle over the semantics, In these days of hopelessness, empty pursuit, and endless yearning, we are living in visible fascism ascendant. I say visible because those paying attention watched it survive and thrive under the protection of the state for decades. See Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States. Now it unabashedly follows its agenda with open and full cooperation from the government, from governments around the world. Fascism serves the needs of the state, serves the needs of business, and at your expense. Who profits? Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, Tim Cook, Bill Gates, Betsy DeVos, George Soros, Donald Trump. And need I go on? Let me say it again. Rich guys, who think you're not really all that good, really dig government. Every government everywhere, including communist governments. Because they make the rules that make rich guys richer. Simple. Don't overthink it. Are you patriots in the back paying attention? I'm a man who loves you all. I'm a man who loves you all and this spinning ball so much that I'm going to fulfill my childhood promise. I'm a man who loves you all and this spinning ball so much that I'm going to fulfill my childhood promise to myself to be noble. Here it is in these corporate for-profit concentration camps. Here it is in brown and non-conforming folks afraid to show their faces for fear of the police, Migra, Proud Boys, Beckys. Here it is, a planet almost used up by the market's greed. I'm a black and white thinker. Detention camps are an abomination. I'm not standing by. I really shouldn't have to say any more than this. I set aside my broken heart, and I heal the only way I know how. By being useful, I efficiently compartmentalize my pain, and I joyfully go about this work. To those burdened with the wreckage of my actions, I hope that you will make the best use of that burden. To my comrades, I regret that I will miss the rest of the revolution. Thank you for the honor of having been in your midst, giving me space to be useful. To feel that I was fulfilling my ideals has been the spiritual pinnacle of my life. Doing what I can to help defend my precious and wondrous people is an experience too rich to describe. My trans comrades have transformed me, solidifying my conviction that we will be guided to a dreamed-of future by those most marginalized among us today. I have dreamed it so clearly that I have no regret for not seeing how it turns out. Thank you for bringing me so far along. I am Antifa. I stand with comrades around the world who act from the love of life in every permutation. Comrades who understand that freedom means real freedom for all and a life worth living. Keep the faith, all power to the people. Bella Ciao. That's Wilhelm von Spronson's final statement. It should be noted that he was a member of the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club. In his memory, feel free to start your own chapter of the John Brown Gun and Bomb Club. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain in exile from Ohio at Buckingham Correctional in Dilwyn, Virginia. If you're starting a chapter of the John Brown Gun and Bomb Club, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his latest address at Sean Swain, number 2015638, Buckingham Correctional, P.O. Box 430, Dilwyn, Virginia, 23936. You can find his past writings, recordings of his audio segments, and updates on his case at seanswain.org, or now follow him on Twitter at SwainRocks.
Hey, my name's Nava, and I am currently in Massachusetts. I don't know protocol here because I'm a visitor, but my understanding is that I'm on Nipmuc and Pecumtuk territory in western Massachusetts right now.
Would you talk a little bit about how you came to write Turn the World Inside Out, the emergence of nurturance culture, and who it's intended for and what you hope that it can achieve?
It kind of wrote itself through me, so it's hard for me to say this is the reason I wrote it. I had personal reasons for writing it that were trying to understand things that were happening to me in my life that were just really about trying to understand my own experiences. And also because I stopped being able to read for a while. Like there was for about 6 months I couldn't read at all, and then I slowly was working my way back up, and I teach literature for my job, so I needed to figure out if I was going to be able to write and read again. And I was writing this blog just to have a space that was very, very free and very personal, where I wasn't worried about what I was saying. I was really listening to myself. And the nurturance essay came out of that. And then because the nurturance essay went all over the place, then after that, I was able to write this book. And I guess that's the short story of how it happened. But I don't know if that gets to the heart of the question. I think you're kind of asking something else.
Well, I mean, if it so it started out of your need to express yourself, and then just sort of went like online viral, I think is how it's been described.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of that essay, which listeners may have read or come across, is "The Opposite of Rape Culture is Nurturance Culture." Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
How did you see that spread, and how did people like engage with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there were a lot of different ways. Some of them are funny. For example, I did not mean it to say, but many people received it as, and I looked back on it and I was like, okay, I guess it does kind of say that, for men to get closer to other men, like cis men particularly, to get closer to other men, but all men, like trans men and cis men also. A lot of folks took it as like, oh, we should build relationships with each other. And that was what I was saying. And it's been beautiful. And it touched on, I think what I hadn't fully understood, but that makes sense to me, is that there's this profound need that a lot of masculine identified folks feel to be intimate with each other, that it's denied. And I think part of the reason it spread so quickly was partly because it like created room for that closeness. I was actually saying, you know, challenge each other so that you can be better to everybody else in your life. But it has fostered a lot more openness between men talking to one another, which I think is beautiful. Some of the funny downsides are that it's resulted in like all male panels on masculinity or all male events where only men are invited to come. Mm. And that's not what I meant. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's nice that you're all connecting with each other, but I don't think I meant to create like another, you know,
Boys club.
Boys club, like, we have had all-male spaces before in the world, and I wasn't really suggesting that we should reproduce that. but some of the other things that grew out of it, I think what was happening for me at the time, I was writing about things happening to me, and I was also learning about things that were happening to other folks that I'm not targeted by. So I was like, I sat in on a class that Rachel Zellers taught at McGill, who's this incredible, brilliant Black feminist scholar and organizer, who's from the U.S., but she's based in Montreal now. And, so, you know, some mutual friends introduced us, and I just sat in on her class, and it blew my mind, and I learned an incredible amount in that class. And I didn't write about that because I felt like, you know, it's not my place, and, like, you know, it's not my knowledge or my wisdom or stay in your lane, like, all of that stuff, but was underneath kind of bubbling, and I was thinking about it as a white person trying to understand it. As I was writing about masculinity, I was also thinking about racism. And so when the book happened, I was like, well, clearly, when we're talking about nurturance culture, it resonates more around more kinds of violence and disconnection. If the core idea is that, you know, it's not new, right? This is stuff that I had learned over many years, like reading a lot of different people, that like oppressors also lose something, right? That we lose, if you're, let's say, like a white person in the system, you lose a part of yourself too. And I had sort of understood that that was happening for people who were positioned as men that I was close to, that part of them was like disconnected in some way, not for everybody, but for certain specific people that I'd gotten close to. And in all kinds of ways, I think like existing in a gender binary cuts parts of us off that are really here and that are bubbling up and wanting to come to the surface, you know, for everybody. I think not only for trans and genderqueer folks, but even for cis folks, I'd say that there's, and this is what Serena writes about in that chapter on gender, is that like when we center the folks who are the most targeted by systems of oppression and center that knowledge and then make it the core of what we're looking at, that opens up freedom. It creates a better world for targeted folks, but it also opens up freedom for everybody else who's existing inside oppressive systems. And so I'm kind of like, I've experienced a bit of both, like as a white person with Canadian citizenship, who's like born in, you know, born in Canada, I have a lot of privilege. And then as like a working class person, as a woman who's experienced a lot of harm in my life, as someone who's experienced poverty, you know, both intergenerationally and intermittently in my life. And then also my dad's a Holocaust survivor. So like, it's close in my family. It's for my people, my age, it's usually two generations away. And for me, it's my dad. So, and my uncles and my aunt. So like, I feel like I had this funny place straddling both oppressor and oppressed experiences. And I was just like putting these pieces together, but I knew that I wasn't the right person to talk about race and racism or colonization. So when the book happened and the possibility arose to connect what I was learning to these bigger systems of harm, I was like, well, this has to be relational. This has to be in dialogue with people who really have that knowledge, because I'm not the right person to talk to that. And that's how that grew. So I was like, yeah, we're just going to do conversations, you know? And learn from each other.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Gunas. You're hearing my chat with Dr. Nava Smolish about her recent book, Turn This World Inside Out, The Emergence of Nurturance Culture, published by AK Press.
I really, really appreciate the fact that you made it so conversational and brought in those dialogues and made space for the guests to bring in other points and sort of like push back and challenge. And it actually made it a lot more dynamic. And I think as insightful as the essays that you wrote were, like you and curating like who you brought in because you knew that they had some like things that we all could learn from. I really appreciate that as a reader.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is I don't feel like I did. I don't know that I curated exactly so much as I just opened up and reached out into my own community. Because one of the other things that I was really trying to do was I didn't put out a call for papers or anything like that. It was really just wanting to be like, this knowledge is already here. People know. You don't have to have a degree on something to have expertise on it, right? I had done for a long time, I'd been an organizer in like a grassroots migrant justice organization that was led by folks of color, and it was led primarily by people who'd been through the immigration system. And one of the things that they taught us that we learned there was like the expertise comes from the bottom. It comes from the people who have the lived experience. That is expertise that you look to and you hold up, and it's wisdom. It's more valid than the kinds of stuff that I was learning in school, which often like piggybacks and borrows on that knowledge. and that's just now really central to how I think that if you want to really understand what has to change, you look to the people that have that expertise. And I was lucky in my community to have like relationships, and I just realized, oh, I'm having coffee with this friend, or I'm working out with that friend, and they know this stuff, so let's talk and let's make a chapter together. It kind of grew really organically, which was a little bit tricky for my publisher, because I was like, I need a chapter like this, but I'm not going to go ask someone. It has to just happen. Meant it took longer than maybe expected. But the relationships are really genuine as a result. Like, we're, you know, it matters to me to build trust and not just be like, hey, famous person, will you be in my book? Because I'm really not seeking power at all, like quite the opposite. I really value being able to share power, and that this is everybody's knowledge that we're creating together through pushing each other and challenging each other and being excited to grow across our differences.
Was there anything about your choice of writing under a pseudonym that reflected the like wanting to not make it about personal power?
Yeah.
Or
it feels like this came through me in a bunch of different levels. First, the essays, which were written first, and I, you know, I don't even necessarily still agree with everything in those essays. They were what I was thinking at the time. They just grew really intuitively. They almost wrote themselves. And then I wanted to just give it to the world in a way that wasn't really too connected to me, if that makes sense. Because it feels like I didn't make up a lot of that stuff. Like, a lot of it is things that I've learned, and that it's implicit at some point. If you learn something 15 years ago, it's there. And it's hard to track back. So when we were making the book from the blogs, I had to go back and like resource everything and reference everything. And it feels like it's not really about me as a person. It's relational. And that's gotten really reinforced in the last little while. Like, of course, then once you're like putting a book out and then asked to do, you know, represent the book, then there's a certain responsibility that comes in where you're like, well, I did make this book, so I'm responsible for it. And you can start to feel like you have to have everything figured out, and I definitely don't. And I'm not trying to be like, hey, I have all the solutions. It's really just I want to be in conversation, and particularly right now when we're experiencing really different kinds of harm. Like, the harms that are most ratcheted up right now are not directly targeting me a lot, although it's creeping over more and more to targeting me, like the Tree of Life shooting. you know, targeted people that I know and that are, you know, it's, I am in a community that we can't expect that we'll stay safe just because we stay out of the mess, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's been a mistake in the past to be like, oh, you know, just keep your head down and it won't affect you. That's not true. Eventually we all get affected one way or another. But I'm not in the most targeted group right now. So it feels like there's this distance and a gulf in life experience. And we don't have to necessarily be best friends to have solidarity. Like, it's okay to have intimacy with folks that are like you, mm-hmm. while also reaching across and showing up for people. Like, and I've been scared since Trump came in. I had that collapse when it first happened, and then I had to understand that this wasn't new for a lot of people. It was just stepped up.
Yeah.
That this kind of violence is the foundation of Western culture, and it's been there the whole time, but suddenly it's apparent and increasing in pace. And I've been in kind of paralysis mode, and over the last little while with the a lot of the ICE blockades and like resistance finally really kicking up in a loud way with like some of like with Cosecha and like some of the migrant justice groups that are just like fighting and organizing, I'm finally feeling hopeful and feeling less scared and less paralyzed. And I just went to this training recently that really helped, because it's like, no, you can do this. Ordinary people can do this. You don't have to be somebody special. It's always been ordinary people who were stepping in, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's in a way that has each other's backs, whether or not we're going to automatically listen to the same music and wear the same clothes and like each other. Like, you know,
sure.
How do you build trust when you don't automatically have the same background or the same culture so that you can protect each other?
In the response to the El Paso shooting and the Dayton shooting, a listener and a friend had read a tweet by Bree Newsom that this guy didn't disagree with, but he just didn't fully understand. And so we like had a chat where she named one of the causes of the shooting to be male entitlement. And so we sort of had like a nice chat about that. And it's like mass shootings are this really spectacularized amplification of the violence that's already so present in a really sick patriarchal, like heterosexist, white settler, anti-black, like I could go on listing like ableist society that we live in, or that we both live in, even on different sides of the border. They're like similar, they're cousins. But it, like, this sort of violence is always like bubbling underneath the surface, or it's like impacting people on a more like personal one-on-one basis that doesn't make the news through like familial violence or intimate violence or microaggressions on the subway or whatever. Could you talk about some of the like insights that putting this project together or your conversations have brought you that maybe like listeners could understand about like the connection between like a fear of a loss of entitlement and lashing out and that relationship?
So I was thinking about that story that I think we've talked about before, right? But that book, Why Does He Do That? By Lindsay Bancroft, I found really helpful. Is that kind of the stuff you're thinking about?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a story that Lindsay Bancroft uses in this book that after I wrote the Nurturance essay, because at the time when I was writing the Nurturance essay, I was deep, deep, deep in empathy for someone who was harming me and several other people who I had observed causing harm. And I was trying to feel as deeply into that experience as I could to try to understand it. And so I got part of the way to understanding, but I missed a big piece of the picture. And as I moved away from that, I think it has its place, but a whole bunch of friends put this book in my hands and were like, you need to read this book. There's a big piece of this puzzle you're not understanding. And I read it and it helped explain so much more. It put into words things that I had felt and known, but I hadn't been able to articulate. And there's a story that he tells that I told to my 9-year-old godson, who was trying to understand why he's kind of cute and he has this curly hair and adults are always touching him and putting their hands in his hair. And he has some sensory issues and he hates even people who love him. He has ways that he likes to be touched and not to be touched. Like you give him a firm squeeze hug. You don't like gently touch his hair because it makes him feel, he doesn't like it. And so all these adults are always touching him without asking first. And he's learned how to say, I don't like when people touch me. But we were talking at dinner and he was asking, why do people always do this? And his mom was trying to explain that he's a kid and so they don't really listen to him. And I realized this story would help and it would also teach him, you know, he's also a big kid and he has to learn about other people's boundaries too. And the story is there's a little boy, and from the time he's very young, his family tells him, and they really believe, and they tell him that there's this beautiful, big area, this piece of land that belongs to the family, they say. And they tell him, for now, while you're a child, because you're so generous, you're allowing the community to use this land. But it's really ours, and when you grow up, you're going to inherit it, and it will belong to you. And you're just allowing people to fish and hunt and camp and enjoy the territory, the land that that our family owns. And the boy goes many times to visit the land, and he walks around on it, and he feels really good about his generosity as he sees people camping and enjoying the land. And he knows that when he grows up, it'll be his. But for now, they're sharing it. And then the time comes when he comes of age, and his family says, okay, now it's time. And he goes to the land, and he says to the people that are there, all right, well, all of these years, you know, you've enjoyed our generosity, and the time has come for me to take the land back, so please, time to leave. And it's not actually true that it belongs to his family. They've been mistaken, and he's been mistaken, but he's been told this since he was very young. Actually, the land belongs to the community. You can think of it as crown land, or you can think of it as like a state park or a big public park. And he's just wrong. It's not the case that belongs to him. And so the people there are a little bit like, who do you think you are? Like, this isn't yours, and we're allowed to be here. This belongs to everyone. And then he gets angry because he feels like he's being pushed back on or, not only are they not appreciating how generous he's been, but mm-hmm. they're refusing to leave, and they're taking what's his. And he gets angry. He starts, pushing their things. He starts taking their things and trying to get it off the land or breaking their stuff. And, they get mad at him. And it's understandable that they get mad at him because he's behaving really badly. But he's behaving badly because he believes that something that is his by rights is being pushed back on in a way that's bullying him or oppressing him. And Lindy Bancroft uses that story to describe the making of an abusive man. So someone who believes that they not only have the right to their own body, but your body too. And I've known people who have this mindset. And it's not to say that this is generalized or that all men have it. Of course, many, many people can grow up in a system that encourages that kind of system thinking and nonetheless be kind and empathetic and caring and have good boundaries. But that the culture might foster it. So if it's not being countered at home, you might, all of the TV, all of the movies, all of the pop culture, video games, like it teaches that if you're born into this particular type of body and that is who you identify as, and if you do all the right things, you're owed certain things. Like you're owed a pretty wife, and you're owed a nice house, and you're owed an income that can support a family, and you're owed a certain amount of deference. You're owed not only to be treated as an equal, but to be deferred to, and that's yours by rights. And so there's a mindset that treats that as natural and says, well, if this woman or non-cis dude expects to be an equal, that they're somehow imposing, that they're taking up more than their fair share. And it's a mistake. It's not accurate. But people can really experience it as that, as like an imposition on their God-given rights or their natural rights. And I think of it like, I've tried to extrapolate that and understand that, what it would be like, what it means for me growing up as a white person in this society, that like, I even think of it in a simpler way. Like if you grew up sitting on 3/4 of the couch and the other person mm-hmm. who's the same size as you only gets a quarter, you might not notice because you're comfortable and you've been there the whole time, but they're getting squished. When they sort of push you and say, hey, move over, you might feel like you're being oppressed.
There's a quote that's in the book that I don't know if that was attributed to Audre Lorde or what, but it sort of like said something similar that really struck out to me, and I wish I had it accessible right now. But yeah, if you're used to a level of privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Oh, that one. Yeah, that's the mystery quote. No one knows. It's a rabbit hole. Many people have used it. No one knows where it comes from, and no one's ever. I have not yet found, of all the people that I've seen who quote it, people are like, we don't know who said this, which is beautiful because it's all shared knowledge. And I'm like, I wish the whole thing could be like that. Right. When you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. That's exactly it. You feel like you're being pushed back on, but you don't realize that you have been stomping on people and not even realizing it. Because it's like gravity. All you're doing is walking, but the whole system is structured so that your experience of just walking is walking on other people, and it's set up that way. So then when people push back, you just feel that you're being pushed on, and people can get really dangerous, right? Like, push back on white people's sense of everybody's the same, and white people get really dangerous, like scary dangerous.
with and a very that fragile loss. Like undercoat, and just feeling like any sort of pushback is an attack on us and our integrity or our right to exist.
Yeah, and that it's racism, like reverse racism, you know, all of which is just such a profound lack of empathy, like a profound inability to really recognize what's happening around you. And I'm experiencing both of those. Like I've spent years trying to learn and recognize and listen deeply to people of color who are talking about their experiences, whether through reading or listening or organizing, you know, like slowly trying to build relationships where you keep showing up and people are like, yeah, you said this up thing, and you're like, oh, thanks, and then you keep coming back mm-hmm. being like, okay, cool, I'm gonna keep learning. Like, and I think we need that. We need to just keep showing up and keep learning and being really, really open to growing our ability to recognize things that our entire conditioning teaches us not to recognize. And that's, you know, the same kind of thing that I've been asking, that I was hoping that men in my life would do, you know, with mixed success.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it can be painful to do it because it means questioning foundations that we grew up with.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Gunas. You're hearing my chat with Dr. Nava Smolish about her recent book, Turn This World Inside Out, The Emergence of Nurturance Culture, published by AK Press. There was something in the last thing that you said kind of sparked me thinking about another story about a child that you relate in this in the book. You know, where the kind of activity that you were saying was good modeling just now, you know, of like going and being in space and listening to people, and then when a person of color, for instance, says you did this kind of thing, being able to take that and be like, oh, all right, thank you for sharing that. That must have been like an
yeah, like that's to share. That's generous. Like that's mm-hmm. a gift, right? Yeah, to receive it as a gift. So here's the thing. I think I'm not. This connects in, but it might be in a big roundabout way because a lot of that stuff isn't new, right? Like a lot of that is things that I've learned previously and were just floating around for me, and that came out in the writing because I was trying to understand them. Often I write as I'm learning, actually. So it's not me being like, I'm an expert and I'm going to tell you what to do. It's me absorbing. Oh, this is what that person meant. Oh, okay, now I understand because I write to think. But if there's anything in the writing that I think might be a little bit new, it's the thinking of all of this long tradition of challenging oppression that comes for a long ways before me, and I'm not one of the main people who's written it, but connecting it into the nervous system. I'm like, why is it that we get these defensive reactions and that our entire sense of self collapses when someone's like, hey, that thing you did is a super white person thing to do. Please stop. It's like hurting people. Why do we collapse? Like, why does that happen? Why do white people get super defensive and crazy? And also, what do we have as a gift in us that can counter it? And I think it was through some struggles that I was having. So I have a dissociative disorder caused by gendered violence, among other things. And as I was learning, initially when I found that out, I didn't have words and I couldn't access words for any of the things that were happening to me. But as I was healing that, I was integrating layers of myself that had been shamed. Like shame and terror when I was developing had caused these fragments to happen. And as I was integrating, I was like learning that actually that's very common, that almost all of us have parts of ourselves that have been fragmented off so fully that we can't access them. Not everybody has it to the extent that I did, and some people have it even more than me, but it's actually not unusual. It's a way that our systems cope with shame when we're very young. I was learning about that because dissociative disorder is caused externally. It's not something you're born with. It's caused through attachment trauma or breaking of belonging. And so I just was reading all this stuff about attachment and attachment and attachment trauma and betrayal. I trust betrayal trauma. And meanwhile, I was putting that into everything that I had been learning for many years about racism and kind of understanding that one of the things that's so messed up and causes such compounded trauma is not necessarily an act of racism or an act of systemic violence. It's that plus the bystanding and the normalizing of it. That there's a sense of betrayal when harm is happening and the humans around you don't see it or can't see it, there's a fundamental break in our sense that our nervous systems require to know that we are connected to the other humans mm-hmm. that we are close to. Usually specific other humans, like attachment attaches to specific other people. But I think that there's a gift in our nervous systems that allows us to understand our ecological belonging and our social belonging in a less intimate sense, but still very deep. Like when we go into the forest or you're in a wild place, our nervous systems developed over many, 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 many eons to be part of webs of life. And it's not an idea, it's a physiological reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what this Western culture has denied and told us not to notice, not to pay attention to. We're all individuals. We're supposed to bootstrap ourselves to success. We're not supposed to need each other too much. Needs are bad. The lone wolf, like riding off into the sunset, is a good thing. You know, I'm mixing metaphors there, but like the cowboy, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. But that's valorized. And that's not our physiological or biological reality. And as a cultural worldview, it denies a lot of physical reality. And when I was writing in the Nurturance Culture essay, nothing in this child's world gives him any signposts, and yet it's true. Mm-hmm. I was trying to feel towards this deeper sense of belonging that our nervous systems give us in concentric circles. Yes, we belong. We're more intimate with a set certain people. We have children and partners and parents and siblings and aunts and uncles, and it grows from these profound intimacies where we're meant to be completely held. But it doesn't end there. And I think what's weird about psychology is that it just describes that. And it doesn't understand that maybe our nervous systems are also part of our ecological sense of connectedness in the earth and in other with other humans. And that, for me, is where empathy comes in. We're like, we have a part of ourselves that can feel what other people are feeling. Mm-hmm. It's capable of it. But it's not automatic. It has to be honed, and it can be killed in us. It can be numbed in us or shut down. And if we want to feed the kind of culture that can live in balance ecologically and also sort of belong with one another socially, be fully human, be fully expressed, then we need to recognize that our nervous systems are built this way and cultivate that gift. And when that fails, that's when you get things, or when it's not cultivated, you know, that's when you get people growing up, mixing up their internal experience of shame because they don't have connection to that wholeness with, you know, that external person is making me feel bad and I should punish them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's where that story comes in. We're like, you know, at six, he's outgrown this. He laughs about this now because I told him that he was in the book, and mm-hmm. And he, you know, he doesn't really understand what that means, but he kind of got a kick out of the fact that people are reading a story about him. And we told him, like, well, you know, the reason it's interesting is not just because it's about kids, it's because there are adults who don't know that. And he's just like, what? That's so silly.
Silly is a good word for it.
He didn't know, but by eight he knew. You know, because we worked with him to be like, yeah, no, you did this thing that hurts somebody. We love you. You're good. You belong fundamentally. That's unbreakable. But like, go say sorry, or like, go not necessarily say sorry like in the, you know, shame way, but go check what that person needs. Mm-hmm. Like, I love, there's this close friend of mine who I've learned a ton from, my friend Shania, and one of the first things I learned from her about parenting kids, and everybody, I'm not proposing that I know how to parent, like everybody's going to parent differently and that's fine. It's more just that I think about this in terms of adult relationships too, because often what kids need, grown-ups need too, mm-hmm. is when somebody hurts somebody else, you don't go say sorry, because that's often very fake and superficial. Mm-hmm. You ask what they need. So with her kids, if one kid hurt another kid, she'd be like, she'd model, she'd turn to the kid who got hurt and be like, are you okay? Do you want a hug? What do you need? Like, yeah. It's more about meeting the person's needs than it is about shaming the person who did something wrong, although an apology can go a long way. Mm-hmm. And to teach that, you know, watching kids learn it, because as I've been healing, I've been watching healthy parenting, I've also been reparenting myself, and then thinking about my adult relationships too. Mm. But I mean, that's a roundabout story, but does that answer that a little bit?
Yeah, awesome. There was, I mean, just to get to the specific, a child, like, does something out of frustration that ends up hurting their parent, and then mistakes the feeling of sorrow for having hurt or being told that they've hurt their parent for being accused of being a bad person, right? Which is like that kind of a lot of people are like, you know, if someone's told like that thing that you just did is racist, then they hear that as, well, you're racist.
Bad.
You are this thing, as opposed to you are this person that did this thing.
which is reparable. Yeah. If you are this thing, that's not reparable. That's a statement of like
essence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and then of course there's the whole like, you know, it's not about you at your essence having something wrong with you. It's that this culture we live in positions us to cause harm. And so it's not that you are or are not racist. That's like not the point. It's like you, when you take a step, you're taking a step in which gravity has been structured to cause harm to people. Like, and to work with that and be like, oh, okay, so I have to step differently. I have to like recognize the gravity that I'm operating in.
I experience that society teaches us to think in terms of essentialism and putting people in boxes, or like saying someone is this thing, therefore they should go to prison for the rest of their life because
To be irremediably, exactly. Yeah, to be like a degenerate human who can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, or to be a, you know, the type of person who XYZ.
Yeah.
And then that creates these swimming upstream experiences for people who are having all this shit thrown at them that's got nothing to do with who they are at all.
Mm-hmm. Especially because those values are like thrown, especially down the social hierarchy on more and more people, and accumulate in all these intersecting ways. Like, yeah, it's pretty terrible.
I
like how in the introduction you started off with stories of the Windsor House as this like experiment of looking at like just sort of observing kids who have accountability with each other and feel this, and are like socialized to have this interconnectedness with each other. But maybe socialized, I don't know if that's like too hard of a word to like re-education-y. If it's something that fulfills a lot of their need for like nurturance and trust that they can hear critique from other people around them and know that it's not a judgment of their essential being. I think that's really inspirational.
Even more for me that the kids, you're not powerless there, because if you get hurt by somebody, you can get heard. You can get a remedy. Mm. And particularly I think that holding the circle, because what I'm learning and really understanding more profoundly is that you have to have a container in order to have values that you decide is what this group of people are going to do. You have to be like, we set baseline expectations for how we treat one another in this circle. Mm-hmm. And if you can't meet those are the conditions required to be part of this particular circle of humans. And otherwise, you have this strange free-for-all where people are like, well, who decides? And I'm like, we decide. Mm-hmm. We decide that it's not okay to do this or that harmful thing to other people. And I recently had an incredible experience, for me anyway. I don't know if the person who caused harm will agree. Maybe it'll take 5 or 10 years before they agree. But I recently was at a retreat where we had a pretty tight container. It was like 35 people. And the organizers all had long, deep relationships with each other. They'd known each other for years, and they had a lot of trust. And there was someone who was, like, pushing boundaries, you know, like, asking to cuddle with people who may or may not have been there for that. And, you know, then, like, getting closer with folks, like, asking to take clothes off, who were, like, not saying no, but not really enthusiastically saying yes either, and just kind of kept doing stuff like that. And after asking them to stop, and then they couldn't, sort of, they weren't in a place where they could take the feedback in a way that would allow them to stop quickly enough. And it was just a week long thing. And we were there for something else. We were not there for that. So the organizers were like, okay, we've asked you to stop. You haven't stopped. This is changing the dynamic of the group. People are not here for this. And we can't take the whole rest of the week just to work on this with you, because that'll stop us from doing the goals that we came here for. We're not doing that. They asked the person to leave, but I've never before seen it done in such, I was like, this is real. We can do it when we have a solid container. The person was asked to leave, but there wasn't like malicious gossip or back talk. It was just like, this is the thing they were doing. We understand that they also have their own history and their own reasons and their own pain, and this isn't that they're a bad person, but what they were doing was causing them to like disrupt this space. They've been asked to leave. They were given an they were, some people bought them a bus ticket, people took them to the bus, we checked in to make sure they got home, got across the border, and one person that they asked for and who agreed committed to be their like ongoing contact person for the next weeks and months, to be like check in, see how they're doing, do this work with them, so that the people that they were impacting did not have to do any of it. Like the directly affected folks got to just go on with their week. They did not have to process with that person. They did not have to make sure they were okay, because the rest of the circle held it. The people who were not getting directly affected moved into one or two of them, and then the organizers moved into that role. And it was amazing. And then when it was explained to the group why that decision had been taken, it wasn't like, man, that person sucks and there's good and bad people. It was like, you know, if they've been conditioned through patriarchy to not be able to read cues, they have to do that work. This isn't the place to do that work, but we understand that they have, they're a person and they have their own history of pain, but mm-hmm. we're centering the needs of the people who chose to be here who don't want to have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we ask that people not gossip and not be mean about it, and we're just going to go on with the program. And that was respected.
That's awesome.
Like, there was a little bit of working it out. Like, people who were friends with that person needed to know what had happened. There was a lot of transparency about the process. And then the next day, people were like, back to the trainings we came here to do, and there wasn't a lot of nastiness about it at all. Neither towards the people harmed nor the person causing harm. Just like, okay, the container was held, on with the program, someone's checking in with them, folks are checking in with the folks who've been harmed, their needs are taking priority. And we were all just like, this can work. I understand how it works, but it only works when you have a circle.
Yeah.
And the person and belonging in that circle is contingent on agreeing to respect those ways of doing things.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Gunas. You're hearing my chat with Dr. Nava Smolish about her recent book, Turn This World Inside Out, The Emergence of Nurturance Culture, published by AK Press.
It's interesting, like, because that makes me think of, I guess, which this wasn't an accountability process. This was like an immediate solution to like a conflict. But but like with accountability processes, like the things that I've witnessed, like for the most part, it at a certain point, like there may be faults in the way that a thing is structured or the way that it has like resolution or the way that it communicates with people that have been most directly harmed in terms of how that goes. But one of the big flaws is often the lack of connectivity where someone can just like get frustrated, get up, move somewhere else. And are like, they can do that anyway, but where they're like willing to, where their connection to this community where the harm has taken place and where they've helped harm people is so limited that they just feel like they can discard it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're like, oh, you're trying to hold me accountable? Bye. Yeah. See you later. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the many, many kinds of manipulation that some folks do when they're asked to be accountable. I've watched so many of these processes now, and if there isn't a strong container, then it's very difficult to be like, well, if you want to be in this community, these are our standards, you have to meet them, because it's very difficult to say, we care about you and we'll work with you, but you can't take up space publicly or grow power. I think there's also a really big difference between, I don't know if this connects to what you're saying or not, but it might, tell me if it does. There's a really big difference between belonging and having power over or being on a stage or self-promoting or like, you know, and in the North American kind of organizing world, there's a funny tension because a lot of us get into it just because we care about things and we want the world to be a better place and we're not trying to be visible in any way. Like my most comfortable place is a background role. I'm most comfortable being like a runner. You know, I get food. I make people get people places to sleep. Like I pick people up. Like that's where I'm comfortable. I'm very, very, very uncomfortable being public in any way. It's not my nature. I'm super introverted. And like if this book thing hadn't happened, I wouldn't be doing this. And I have a love-hate relationship with it. I mean, it's fun to build more relationships, but putting a person above is not something that I feel is really appropriate or good for movements.
Yeah.
But there are folks who want to be above and who want to be on stage and who really crave being looked at and attention given to them and like becoming gatekeepers. And those folks can do weird things to keep that power. And I think it's important to distinguish and say, look, if you're someone who, like, for example, the Charlie Glickman case, which is super public, I don't know if you followed that at all. It's not in my world directly. It's a sex educator kind of world, which is adjacent to mine. So it's been interesting because I've watched it from a distance. It's not my own community. But he's this, like, very powerful sex educator who was pretty well known and was a gatekeeper who could keep, this is all out on the internet. You can look it up. You know, I found out as this was happening that he could decide whether people got work or not. Like he had quite a lot of power and he was doing the kind of subtle manipulative gaslighting abuse for a long time with this one former partner. And it all finally came out and turns out lots of people had those experiences with him. And many people reached out towards him to say, you know, you're important to this community. We care about you. here's what you're doing that's harmful. Can we do a process with you? But in the meantime, can you stop self-promoting yourself? Like, stop doing talks and, like, putting yourself up on stage as an expert. Like, clearly you've got issues to work on before you put yourself out as an expert and gain power.
Yeah.
And I think people who have that maybe, like, slightly narcissistic traits or, like, are a bit disconnected from themselves internally might not know the difference between being told, hey, don't be on stage. Just, like, be in the room, one of the many, you know, with everybody else. They might not know the difference between that and being shunned or canceled.
Yeah.
They might literally not know what you're talking about. Like, but the only way I can belong is if I'm on stage, you know?
Or the only, yeah, the
and
only
there are
way
many
I contribute.
Ways to belong.
Yeah.
What?
Or the only way I contribute, and when we, like, build models where some, I mean, no one is replaceable. Like, that's a given, but where, like, if someone's doing movement work or intellectual work or academic work or physical labor or whatever, like, we should be trying to model our communities in ways where, you know, it's not just up to this one person who could fail at any time, hypothetically, or need a break or whatever else. Like, putting it in, like, the best possible perspective. If there's, like, well, I just have these really important things to say, and, like, well, cool, like, give the mic to someone else and, like, share your ideas and let someone else be the one vocalizing it for a while. Kill your own internal, like subcommandante Marcos, you know?
Right. And there are lots of ways to be part of communities that don't accrue power, that just accrue relationship and trust, which is so much more valuable than having individual power. Like, the organizing spaces that I came up in, you know, for the most part, as a white person in those spaces, sometimes we got asked to help strategize, but my job was to, like, fold the chairs, watch the kids, make the food. Like, that's a beautiful role. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think, oh, you know, I'm not really contributing that much because I'm not contributing to, like, strategy, but I'm not a good chess player. I'm really good at taking care of kids and fetching people. Like, and that's okay. Like, there's lots of different roles, and that created, like, long-term relationships that are much more meaningful and beautiful for me than, you know, the type that form when you're publishing articles and getting a reputation or getting famous, which is sort of a skimming the surface type. You can meet interesting people, but then relationship building is separate from that. It has to happen separately. Mm-hmm. And it's so important, especially right now, because our relationships of trust are what we have to protect us in these times that we're moving through now. If I, like, that I have to build where I live and that I have to be accountable to people in relationship over the long term, like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, that's how real solidarity forms, where you can be like, yeah, you know, we might not be best friends, but, like, if you're going to be deported, I will show up and I will surround the van and I will stop that. Or, like, if you're, you know, those kinds of genuine things. And I think, you know, an interesting piece of it also is around, like, the quality maybe in organizing spaces of having a bit of a scene, like trying to be cool. That I'm just so done with that. Like, I'm not cool. I've never been cool. I'm a big nerd. That's not true. I was cool for 2 years when I was 18 and 19, and then it was over. You know, and I think it's okay that a lot of us come to this because we're really soft people, or, you know, gentle people who want a world that is livable for caring, kind people. And I think the world currently is being run by sociopaths, and, like, that's just the reality of it. And so how do we create care where all of the gifts and beauty that people are bringing into this world can grow and can be called on and can come out into the world? Like, we need to create culture that deeply sees each other and can really accept one another as we truly are. You know, whether that's, like, respecting people's pronouns, you know, is a tip of the iceberg. Really seeing people for who they truly are all the way down, that's a completely different kind of culture. And I think that's kind of what I'm hoping for when I say, you know, the opposite of that nurturance is the opposite of violence, or that violence is nurturance turned backwards, is, like, it's not like, oh, a direct opposite. It's much bigger. That acceptance is much bigger than rejection. This one body worker, this naturopath that I was working with, said that to me one time when I was dealing with trying to get rid of parts of myself that were doing things I didn't like. And I said, can't you just get rid of it? And she said, no, you have to accept it. And I said, how do I accept these parts of myself that feel so shameful? And she said, acceptance is not the opposite of rejection. Acceptance is much bigger than rejection. It's not like, oh yeah, you just accept this bad thing that you're doing. It's that you accept your whole self. you love your whole self, and then you get more able to relate to others in a more full, whole, loving kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to expand that in all of these relationships where we're protecting one another to be accountable, but also to be really able to see each other as we truly are. Just the surfaces. Not in a simplistic way, not like, oh, we're all the same, kumbaya.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just white bull, but like in a really profound way of like, who are you actually? And even though we're different, how do we connect and take care of each other?
I guess I was thinking to kind of wrap this up on that point. I'd like to do a thing that like one of the other like podcasters that I work with or that I'm friends with, Tim, who does the Soulcast, does that I kind of like. At the end of his episodes, he asks people, and particularly because, as you said, like this piece of work is a byproduct or is like a product of a lot of hands and a lot of brains over a lot of time.
Yeah.
I wonder if there are any like, besides why does he do that, if there are any titles that you might direct people for like further inquisition. Particularly, I'd like to hear if there are any titles in either attachment theory, which we didn't get too deep into, but I know there's a lot of good books that have been written about it, or the physical implications of in the limbic system of shame and stuff like that. Like, I definitely want to read more on those topics, but any sort of book recommendations that you want to throw out to the listenership, I'm sure would be much appreciated.
When we came from, there was a page called How to Not Re-Injure Survivors, and that started out as just me trying to get good resources together for gendered violence, but it grew from there, and it's got a lot of different kinds of references about systemic violence and how to stand up to it in a way that humanizes everyone, but really does stand up to violence, whether it's coming from the state or coming from one another or coming from supply chains or coming from capitalism, wherever the source is of it, to be able to stand up and say, hey, I see this and it's not okay, while also recognizing the humanity of all of the humans and the living beingness of all the beings that are involved in all of these structures.
That's awesome. Yeah, I see I pulled it up right here, so it's very...
There you go, yeah.
Very good. How can people find your book?
They can find the book everywhere. AK Press is amazing and has a very, very wide distro. They can go to any little bookstore, any little local bookstore they want, and ask for it, and they can get it in. It's also available if they don't have it already. And actually, that's a big help. If they call their local little bookstores, if they get a couple of requests, they're more likely to keep it in stock. Mm. And it's also in all the big bookstores, like the, you know, Barnes & Noble and whatever. And they can also get it directly from AK Press. For, I believe there's even a discount if you go through AK Press currently. If they live in the States, if you live elsewhere, it's a little trickier to get it directly from the publisher. So it's better to go through a bookstore, like literally all over the world. That's part of what's so wonderful about AK, is that this little radical anarchist publisher who distros globally, they work so hard.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having this conversation.
Thank you.
This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Gunnis. This show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions and suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or thefinalstrawradio@protonmail.com. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816.